Welcome to The Compliance Files, brought to you by Compliance Institute. The Compliance Files is a unique podcast series giving you access to industry insights and key perspectives on how the evolving regulatory landscape is driving change, bringing challenge and opportunity for compliance professionals everywhere.
I'm Kathy Jacobs, former president of the Compliance Institute and experienced compliance professional, and it is a great pleasure for me to host this podcast. Authorization plays an important gateway role in protecting consumers by ensuring firms are authorized and regulated by a supervisory authority. It is a license to operate in a jurisdiction, and therefore the process for obtaining one can be onerous and demanding. And the obligations don't stop when you receive that coveted authorization. To explain and to try to navigate the authorization process, I'm delighted to welcome as my guest today, Russell Burke, an authorization expert and leader. Russell is one of Ireland's leading payments experts. In 2021, Russell established Juristic Limited, a consultancy business that specializes in advising both applicant and regulated payments and e-money businesses. He is a non-executive director and chair of the audit committee of the regulated e-money institution MyPos Limited, and also non-executive director of Associated Foreign Exchange Limited, a member of the Corpay Group and a regulated payments institution in Ireland. Russell has over 45 years experience in banking and payments. He spent 36 years with Bank of Ireland, spanning retail banking, treasury, offshore, and since 2000, payments, including 7 years on secondment to the Irish Payment Services Organisation, or IPSO, where he was responsible for the establishment of the National Payments Plan for Ireland. He joined the Central Bank of Ireland in 2014, where he spent a further 7 years as its Senior Payments and Electronic Money Authorisation Specialist. He was also previously a director of the MOBI Forum, the Global Financial Services Industry Association, for 4 years, two as Deputy Chair. Russell is here to discuss with me today the authorisation process and how to navigate this process efficiently and to secure that important authorization. So welcome to the Compliance Files podcast, Russell, and thank you very much for talking to us today.
Thanks very much, Cathy, and thank you very much for having me here. It's indeed my pleasure to take part in this podcast, and hopefully I can pass on the benefit of some of my experience to your listeners.
If we start at the beginning, who needs an authorization from the Central Bank of Ireland, and are there different types of authorization?
Just to clarify, I suppose, and you said it out in the introduction there, my background is very much payments, and today we'll be concentrating very much on the authorization process for the payment sector. And when I say the payment sector, I mean payments institutions, e-money institutions, and account information service providers. But just to say, other sectors such as maybe banking or insurance or MIFID, the authorization processes are broadly the same. They're obviously a bit more onerous if you're trying to set up a bank rather than a payment institution and so on. To come back, I suppose, specifically to the payment sector, who needs authorization is a very good question, because there are plenty of services that we might regard as payments that don't require authorization. For instance, if firms are providing gift cards or something like that, they don't need authorization. So I suppose in the payment sector, from a regulatory point of view, the important thing to determine who needs to get authorized is what payments products or services they intend to supply. So if they're looking at the issuance of e-money, then definitely they need an authorization, because the provision of e-money requires that. And then if it's payment services or e-money along with payment services, the types of payments that constitute legal payment services are set out in the Payment Services Regulations of 2018, which are the transposition of what we call PSD2, the Second Payment Services Directive. And I won't list them all out now, but there are seven different legal types of payments. The most common ones are based on the provision of a payment or an e-money account, sometimes with a card on it, sometimes with not. If there's a card on it, it requires a separate authorization because it's the issuance of a payment instrument. The provision of money remittance services, for instance, is one of those regulated services, and what we now call open banking services, such as account information services or payment initiation services, they are also now regulated payment services. So any business, one, whether they need authorization or not, should first establish exactly what type of payment services are they intending to provide, and then check or establish whether those constitute regulated payment services and or e-money services per the payment services regulations and indeed the e-money regulations.
Thanks, Russell. I think you did bring up something very important that might not be obvious to some of our listeners who don't work in payments, and that's payments is a whole raft of services or products, including things like gift cards or debit cards, or and some of them, as you say, are regulated, and but a lot of them are not. So it is even just to determine whether you should be applying for an authorization is a bit of an exercise. So that is an important point.
Yeah, and I suppose it's worth reiterating, it's not always obvious, and that's why it's worth the firm establishing. I mean, obviously, some firms may want to be regulated, you know, they may actually want as part of their development to be a regulated entity, but they've also got to be careful they don't apply for authorization for a service that doesn't require it, because obviously the central bank can't grant that either. Obviously, it's easier to go to market if it's a service that doesn't require that authorization. Gift card is one example. Another one is up to a certain value, payments that are put on mobile phone bills. It's called electronic communications in the regulations, but that's another example of, so in other words, if a firm like Vodafone wants to allow you to purchase using your phone, transact, cinema tickets or something up to a value, I think it's of €50 per transaction or €300 per month, they can provide those services without getting authorization to provide payment services. So yeah, very, very important to establish whether that authorization is needed or not.
Thanks, Russell. And could you just describe the current legal framework? I know it is changing, and actually that is the subject of a separate Compliance Institute Compliance Files podcast. But if you could just describe the current legal framework underpinning the authorization process.
Yeah, sure. I suppose perhaps to answer the question slightly differently, in that the legal aspect of the regulations underpin the requirements for authorization, whereas the process itself is set by the central bank. But I'm going to cover that in more detail throughout this. So I suppose the most fundamental and comprehensive regulations covering the legal requirements of getting authorized are the Payment Services Regulations of 2018 that I mentioned. There's also the Electronic Money Services Regulations of 2011, which have been amended somewhat by the Payment Services Regulations of 2018, but they're specific for firms that are looking for e-money authorizations, of which we are now seeing more of those than pure payment institution ones. And probably the best way, I'll get into it maybe a little bit later if we have time, at a very high level, e-money is where your money is held in an account, like a current account, I suppose, with a bank, and maybe has a card on it or so what, and can be used for making all sorts of payments, whereas payments institutions tend to be something more specific, like money remittance or something like that. But that's really too big a generalization. As I say, the regulations set out both what constitutes payment services, as I've already covered, and it also sets out the requirements for authorization. And these would revolve around the provision of the program of operations for the business plan, the capitalization requirements, the safeguarding arrangements, the structure, the governance, and so on. And then some stuff related to anti-money laundering, the owners of the firm, and so on. So all this stuff has to be provided by a firm to be assessed to see whether they qualify for authorization or not. The authorization process itself in Ireland is set up by the central bank. In fact, when I went in, you mentioned I went to the central bank in 2014. The first big project I was on was in 2015, was establishing what we then called the enhanced authorization process for payments and indeed other sectors. And that process is essentially still the same since. It's been tweaked a bit to accommodate the changes driven by PSD2. But essentially, the central bank has an authorization process which, there are full details on the website. I think in the next question, we're going to cover it in more detail anyway. They've set out what the process is. So essentially, a firm makes an application, has to provide the information that's set out in the regulations, and that's further qualified by the EBA, which is the European Banking Authority's guidelines on authorization for e-money institutions and payment institutions. So it gives further detail on what actually has to be provided in terms of evidence and documentation with the application. So if a firm gets all that and it covers the requirements set out in the regulations and it then submits it to the central bank, it falls into the central bank's authorization process. So the process itself isn't a legal one, if you like. It's a central bank process, but it's based on the legal requirements that are set out in the regulations.
So it's an administrative process hanging out of the legal requirement, really, to have an authorization process.
Yeah, I mean, the central bank as the regulator, and I'm sure the process is broadly similar in most other EU countries and indeed the UK, which was in the EU till recently. Although there are differences, for instance, the FCA in the UK, their submission process is online. So you actually key in the stuff directly into their system, I believe, whereas documents are submitted, albeit in electronic form, of course, nowadays to the central bank. But there are separate documents for each section and so on. So there can be differences, and there are different stages. And I think we're going to cover that now in the next few minutes. I'm happy to take our listeners through the various stages in detail, if that's what we want to do.
Yeah, well, if we could now just take us through what the application process involves, assuming for the moment a happy path.
Yeah, okay. And we're going to get into, I suppose, more details about the happy path or whatever the challenges are to that happy path. But yeah, assuming everything is goes swimmingly, shall we say, and it never does, just to, to make that clear, each application is different. And it's not that there's anything necessarily wrong. It's just that no two applications are the same, no two businesses are the same, and so on. So there's always things that the firm needs to provide that might be different to another firm, or the central bank needs to understand better. But just to take our listeners through the process, and again, later we're going to cover what a firm should do before actually applying. Assuming they are applying, the first thing they do is they let the central bank know that they're going to apply and arrange for what is called a pre-application meeting. When I worked there, this was voluntary. It's now mandatory. And the purpose was very much, when I was there, to allow firms ask the central bank questions about what the process entailed. In other words, try and avoid any surprises later on, so they understood the central bank's expectations. But it has evolved now into, and I think it's quite a good thing. Sorry, I'm not saying it's a bad thing by any means. It has now evolved into an opportunity, an early opportunity for a firm to get feedback on at high level on their application and the nature of it. So before the pre-application meeting happens, a firm is asked to submit a 5-page document. It's called a key facts document. And it basically sets out at high level the key aspects of their application. And I touched on some of them earlier when talking about the requirements. Typically include details of the program of operations, which is essentially the e-money and or payment services they intend to provide, the legal ones, and indeed any ones that don't require regulation, the business plan, essentially the monetary aspect of it, you know, the financial projections and capital requirements and so on. The structure of the firm, in other words, the number of staff they're going to be there, the composition of the board and management team and so on, the capitalization, how that's going to be provided, their post safeguarding requirements. Safeguarding is a key element, as your listeners probably know, of for payments institutions and e-money institutions. It's the biggest protection of the lot, payment service provided by e-money institutions and payments institutions. Banks can lend out that money. You know, banks that provide payment services can lend out customers' money. Payments institutions and e-money institutions cannot. The money has to be safeguarded there to protect the users, just in case anything goes wrong. So payment service users can be very reassured the regulations protect them there. So the safeguarding arrangements are set out, very important. And then the governance, you know, the arrangements in relation to oversight of any outsourcing arrangements, the composition of the board, whether there's any risk committees, audit committees, you know, that kind of stuff. And then some information on the ownership of the firm, if it's part of a group and so on, basically the shareholders and the or any qualifying holdings that might be involved. So basically a high level, or if you like, I suppose, a summary version of what's going to be the application. So that goes into the central bank week before the pre-application meeting. And whilst some firms regard that as a bit scary or, you know, whatever, I'd actually look at it the other way. I'd say there's a great chance for a firm with its ideas, with its proposal, to get early feedback from the central bank on what it thinks of that. That gives it an opportunity to tweak its application to accommodate any feedback they get from the central bank ahead of making that application. So I think it's a very useful process. So anyway, what happens is the that pre-application key facts document goes in, and a week later the firm has the meeting with the central bank, and the central bank will have reviewed that document and will tend to give feedback at high level to a firm. And the firm gets the chance to ask any questions about the process or any questions about some of the feedback it gets. And then typically the central bank will ask the firm when it intends to make its application. It's not asking the firm to commit to a date. It's more the central bank itself, like all public service bodies, has limited resources and a constant flow of applications. So it's more just to manage their own workload. They like to know when a new application is coming in, because obviously it increases the workload. And there's no obligation on the firm, as I say, to submit at a particular time. But obviously, if a firm didn't do it in a reasonable time after this, it may be asked to have a new pre-application meeting in case the business plan has changed or whatever. So that's the first step. Second step then is submission of the application. Central Bank have a secure email system for submitting this. Where you email, it's simply applications@centralbank.ie. So it's very simple, asking for access to this portal. And with that will come instructions on how to use it. It gives details on the formatting of the documentation and so on. You know, I've obviously been involved in this a number of times on both sides. It's very straightforward. There's going to be a lot of documentation with an application, so it's important that it's labeled correctly and so on. Access to that portal is given and the application is submitted. So the next stage of the application then is acknowledgement. And very simple, the central bank literally acknowledge receipt of the application. Sometimes, you know, maybe all the documents don't go through or something like that, so there may be a resubmission or something may be required. But typically it all goes through fine, and the central bank has a commitment to acknowledge all applications within, I think it's 2 working days, maybe 3, of receipt of this. But typically it's done same day or next day, depending on the arrival of it. The central bank then has a 10 working day service standard for the next stage, which is what's called the key information check. The central bank, when it gets the application, assesses the application at high level to ensure everything that's needed to assess the application is actually included with it. So it's more a quantitative rather than a qualitative check. So if, for instance, a firm has forgotten to, let's say, include a certificate of incorporation or something like that, central bank come back and say, look, we're not going to start this till you give us that. Now, in recent times, they'll be probably asking a few more questions than that. They're probably straying into the qualitative rather than quantitative aspect of it. But again, it doesn't really, it's not wasted effort on the firm's part, because obviously if they're missing something, it has to be included. And it's a couple of questions that require answering. They would have been asked at a later stage anyway, so it's better to get it all cleared up. So anyway, within 10 days, the firm will get either pass the key information check or get a response saying what's missing. Then when it provides what's missing, the application will go into what they call the assessment phase, which is the most significant phase of the whole process. This is where the central bank assesses all the documentation that has been submitted and starts assessing any of the people that are already identified by the firm that will ultimately be PCF role holders. That's pre-approval control function holders, typically the board members and the senior executives. We'll get into the detail of it now, maybe later. So if they're already identified, they can submit their what they're called IQs, individual questionnaires, and their assessment of fitness and probity perspective as to whether they're fit and proper to be working for a regulated payment services firm. So that all starts. The central bank has its own 90-day service standard for that, which they pretty much adhere to, in fairness. But there is a catch in that they will typically come back after the initial assessment. And obviously the first one is the biggest one. It has to go through everything. Maybe would take typically between, I guess, a month and 6 weeks sort of from the application being received. And it will come back with, in some cases, literally over 100 questions about the application. And it asks the firms for further information, further clarification, or if there's a problem, it tells them there's a problem and it needs to address it. The catch is, when they come back with questions, that service standard clock gets paused until the firm comes back with answers to all of those questions. So if after 30 days, say, or whatever, the comments, they're known as comments, the first round of comments goes out, then that 90-day clock is stopped until the firm comes back with all the answers. And in a lot of cases, the firms come back with insufficient answers or not sufficiently substantial answers, and the central bank say, sorry, that isn't good enough, the clock is remaining stopped until we get the proper answers. Now we're talking about in a clean case scenario here, so typically the firm will answer those questions generally in a pretty quick time, although I'd always advise firms not to rush them, to make sure the answers are obviously, the more clear and comprehensive the answers are, the less chance there will be of further questions on it. And then when those are submitted back, the clock goes on again. Central bank assesses those responses and comes back with any further questions. So let's say it's 100 questions at the beginning, might drop down to 30 the second time. And then possibly if there's a third time, it might drop down to 10 or, you know, something like that. As that process comes to a close, or there's less and less outstanding questions, we move on to the next phase, which is called notification of assessment. So when the central bank has got enough information, the team there that are assessing the application put together what's called a recommendation memorandum to the decision maker, which is typically head of division in the central bank. And it basically sets out its recommendation in relation to the firm. So given that we're talking about a positive and straightforward case here, it'll be a recommendation for authorization. So they will set out, based on the regulations, how the firm is demonstrating that it meets those regulatory requirements and it's recommending a favourable assessment. And so the firm will get a notification of assessment letter, or we call it a minded to letter, which is the next stage, where the central bank gives a letter to the firm stating that it intends to authorise it under either the e-money regulations or the payment services regulations for payment services, whatever they've applied for, typically once a number of pre-authorization requirements have been fulfilled. So typically, even at that stage, most firms won't have injected their capital, may not have opened their safeguarding accounts and so on. So they'll be on a list of things that need to be done. But at least the firm knows at that point, once those things are done, they will get their authorization. So then, assuming that all goes well, then there's a 10-day service standard that once those things are done, now typically, again, it's done almost straight away, but if the decision maker wasn't around or something, I suppose it might take a day or two, but typically it's done next day, the firm will get the notification of decision letter, which is basically a letter of authorization, which is effectively the final stage in the authorization process. There are two other, I suppose, stages that are not even related to getting authorized because they're already authorized at this stage. But the next stage is they appear on the register. The central bank has a register of all authorized firms on a sector by sector basis. So there's one for payments institutions, there's one for e-money institutions. So the firm will appear on that register the next time it updates. I think they run about every 2 weeks in the central bank. And then finally, if the firm intends to provide its services to other European countries, on, you know, like a passport into all European countries, the passport notifications to all those other countries will go out from the central bank. I suppose the final stage then is if there's no objections from the regulators in all the other states, that passporting is confirmed a month after those letters go out. And that there's a service standard, they will go out within a month of the authorization being granted. So I suppose that's the very final stage for firms if they intend passporting into other countries in Europe. So for your question was the happy path. Most people ask, how long does this take? And the answer is always, you know, it's different for every firm. But if it goes really, really well, you're probably talking about maybe a 9-month period from start to finish of what I described there would be as good as it gets. Typically, it's probably closer to a year. When things aren't so good, it can be longer than that. But I think most of those that we've seen get authorized in recent times that have been sort of strong applications would be in around the 1 year mark, I would say, or nine months to a year, perhaps.
Is that a year from the pre-application meeting?
Yes, if the application submission is quite soon or, you know, almost immediately afterwards. But in some cases, firms might take some time to digest feedback from the central bank and maybe tweak the application. So I'd say it's probably more from the date the application is submitted. But again, and in fairness, sometimes applications are delayed. It's down to the firm. Like I say, their firm could take 3 months to submit its application after its pre-application meeting, and the central bank can't do anything about that. Or a firm, as I said, could take a long time to reply to comments from the central bank. So again, by responding to any central bank queries quickly and substantially, the firm can help reduce the elapsed time that's going to take to get its decision. So it's not all down to the central bank. Quite often it can be down to the firm as well.
It's interesting, Russell, that you say that the pre-application meeting is now mandatory. So obviously the central bank, you know, see a value in that, and hopefully firms go into that meeting being quite strategic and knowing what they want to get out of it and to try and get the most out of it. So I think that's very interesting.
Just to jump in on that one, my advice to firms would be don't go into that prematurely. Make sure, you know, you're at a reasonably advanced stage of your decision making and commitment and so on. Because the questions you will ask when you're kind of ready to go or close to ready to go would be far more relevant than if you're at a very early stage.
So moving on to the not so happy path, what are the common mistakes made by firms in their application? And then what are the implications or consequences of those errors? Have you seen any typical kind of mistakes or pitfalls?
Yeah, of course we do. Yeah, there's plenty that don't go so well. And actually what we're just touching on there about the pre-application meeting, as I say, it used to be purely an opportunity for firms to ask the central bank about the process, but now the central bank gives feedback. And I think this is very useful, because if a firm has gone in too prematurely, and the central bank will see that from its key facts document, it'll get that feedback. And the firm is better off getting that feedback at an early stage than going to all the time and effort of putting an application together and then finding out they haven't, you know, done enough or they're not quite ready yet. So in that sense, the pre-application meeting is very useful. So to come back to your question about, in fact, I'll answer the second part first, which is what are the implications and consequences of these errors? Pretty obvious, really. The most common implication of not getting it right is a delay in authorization, or in fact, maybe not getting an authorization at all, although there has been no refusals in the payments and e-money space in Ireland ever, which is good so far, and hopefully it stays that way. Now, there's been a number of withdrawals. The central bank obviously don't announce when a firm withdraws, but sometimes firms make public announcements about it. For instance, Revolut is a famous one, but it withdrew because it got a banking license in Lithuania, not for any although some speculation about it, but the obvious reason they withdrew is because they now had a full banking license in Lithuania. And indeed, anyone with a Revolut account, that's where they're getting their services from. So yeah, the main consequences are delayed or ultimately not getting an authorization itself. So I suppose at high level, the most common mistake is not being sufficiently prepared. We talked about this at the beginning, who requires authorization. So if a firm has a vision and a plan and all the rest, it needs to find out, does it require authorization for the e-money or payment services it intends to provide? Sorry, if they are those. And if so, exactly which authorizations they need. you know, first of all, is it a payments institution or e-money institution? And if it is within those, which of the regulated payment services it wants to provide? Now, if you're providing something like acquiring services for merchants taking cards, that's very straightforward. It's payment service 5, which is the issuing or acquiring of payment instruments. So that's very easy. However, if you're providing a multifunctional e-money account for a general consumer base and providing open banking services with that at the same time, there could be all sorts of payment services involved there. I won't go through them in detail now, but there would be possibly at least 4 different payment services being applied for there. If you're we won't go through them all. The important thing to say is a firm should absolutely establish what is required from a regulatory perspective before it gets into this. Then another common error is, and we've seen a lot of this perhaps with tech firms that want to get into financial services, or perhaps during the Brexit years when firms are already authorized in the UK, that they felt they could kind of go into this fairly lightly. But it's a big commitment. The central bank doesn't look at whether a firm is part of an international group. Well, it does as part of the shareholding and so on, but it will look at the entity that's seeking authorization in Ireland, whether it's part of a multinational group, whether it's a tech firm emerging from somebody's garage or something like that. And it will want to see that there's sufficient heart and mind, as they refer to it, of the business here in Ireland, and that's sufficient substance. Like, even if it only is going to have a small number of customers, it's providing regulated services. It will need to know it has the proper management running that company, that it has a proper board constituted to oversee that management, that it has sufficient controls in place, like head of compliance, head of risk and so on, head of internal audit, in other words, the governance. So a common mistake is not taking that seriously enough. And then I suppose another common mistake is not being able to demonstrate sufficient financial robustness. There are the regulations, and today's not the day to get into detail on them. The initial capital requirements and the minimum own funds requirements, as they're called in the regulations, are set out, and they're very specific numbers calculated based on turnover and so on. But a firm has to demonstrate that will be able to meet those requirements over its first 3 years post-authorization. And it'd be very easy for a firm to put in, you know, massive sales projections and massive profitability and all the rest. But the central bank will challenge that. If it's going to rely on money generated from these projected sales, central bank will look for, you know, credibility around these things. And central bank is very strong on a firm being able to demonstrate that it will meet these financial requirements over its first 3 years of existence. So I keep saying 3 years because that's what the regulation sets out. Obviously, it wants to see them successful in the longer term as well. And then, sorry, one other thing is that there are sufficient resources, both at the time of application and much more importantly, at the time of authorization, in place so that the business that will be providing the payment and or e-money services from Ireland to other EU countries will be sufficiently resourced at the time of authorization for this to go ahead. So it can't be a one-person show, you know, doing all this themselves. It will have to, the firm will have to demonstrate in that application how serious it is about. And I suppose the implication of both the capital and the resources is it requires money. Now, the amount of money depends on the nature of the business and so on, but it does mean that whoever is behind this application or behind the firm that's seeking authorization, to a huge extent, will have to put their money where their mouth is. And a common mistake is they maybe hope or think that they don't have to do that until after the authorization, but in reality that's required to get the authorization. Now, not all the money has to be there necessarily up front, but has to be identified where it's coming in and so on. And quite often, as I mentioned earlier, a condition of authorization, when that notification of assessment comes out, is that the appropriate amount of capital gets injected into the firm. I suppose to summarize, the taking the whole thing seriously enough, the heart and mind of the business being in Ireland, sufficient resources and sufficient finances would be the key mistakes.
Yeah. And if I may, Russell, I'll add one of my own. And as you know, I was involved in a fintech applying for an authorization, and you indeed were our supervisor at the time. Hence why I wanted you on this podcast, because I know how thorough you are. And specifically, you know, for our audience who might, there would be a lot of compliance professionals, and you know, for the heads of risks and compliance, you do need to have a good idea of your internal control or your risk management framework, and to be able to articulate that sufficiently to the central bank so that they know that the new business, you know, on day one, when you know, when they get the authorization, business will be conducted in a safe manner, and that customers, you know, will be protected. So that's just something I would throw in for our listeners, and for those those looking at taking up positions as heads of risk or compliance in, you know, a prospective e-money institution authorised out of Ireland. So just,
yeah,
just
actually, that's covered in the governance arrangements. But specifically now, the central bank's authorization team, which I was once a member of, as you reminded me, and I might remind our listeners, as I said earlier, nobody has ever been refused in this sector. So no suggestion of a negative outcome. But yeah, no, the central bank won't just accept that there's a head of risk or head of risk and compliance, although just on that one, the central bank will typically look for those roles to be not dual hatted. They might have been dual hatted in the past, and they might accept it in a startup situation, maybe to be separated in a year after authorization or something. Yeah. But typically, particularly with risk, they will want, as you say, that, you know, the control functions in the firm to be very, very serious and taken very seriously by the board and so on. And they will typically look for risk framework document, risk appetite statement, a risk register, and so on as part of the documentation. Now, obviously, for a startup firm, it'll be somewhat not hypothetical, but theoretical still, because they're not trading. But they will know their target market. They will know the business risks and so on. And you mentioned I'm on the board of a couple of firms there. For those board meetings, the report on where we are in relation to the business risks is always hugely important. So that's a very well-made point. The central bank will look basically to see that the firm is taking the management of all business risks very seriously and defining its level of risk appetite and what controls it has in place to ensure it stays within that appetite.
So Russell, if we could just flip that and ask, how can a firm or an applicant firm set themselves up for success in this? Are there any tips or insider insights to getting that authorization as quickly as possible?
Again, every application is different, you know, so it's not necessarily one size fits all. And I suppose, like a lot of these things, if you have sufficient money or unlimited money to you know, hire lots and lots of people and, you know, whatever else, that obviously helps. I think probably the most important thing, I touched on it about you know, what do firms get wrong. I mentioned earlier on there's the regulations, there's the EBA guidelines and authorization, the central bank's authorization process itself. But that doesn't tell you the other documentation that the central bank is likely to ask for during the course of the process, like some of the risk documentation I just listed out there. It doesn't tell you how the central bank will react to certain proposed board compositions or the previous experience of proposed PCF role holders. So it's worth finding that out. Now, obviously, as a practitioner in the industry, I'd say go get advice off an expert. But, you know, the payments world is small. Firms know people in other firms. They can ask other firms. They don't necessarily have to spend a lot of money on it. Although I would suggest there's probably no harm in getting some form of support. But I'm not here to sell services today. But yeah, definitely make sure that you understand fully what you're getting into and what's likely to happen. To be honest about it, I mentioned maybe, for instance, not dual-hatting risk and compliance. If a firm proposes to dual-hat both, and there might be a case for doing that, it's likely to be questioned about that by the central bank, whereas if it proposes the two separate from the beginning, that's one hurdle that's not going to present itself during the course of the application. Now, I would say to all applicants or to any businesses, be driven by your business vision and your requirements, and then seek to make that work with the regulations rather than the other way around. Don't have the regulations drive your business plan, because you know your business. The central bank doesn't know your business, and the central bank doesn't set the regulations. It's just there as the gatekeeper function to ensure that you comply with the regulations. For instance, again, back to, say, board composition. When I was working there up until 2.5 years ago, typically firms proposed to have one independent non-executive director. Central bank's pretty much insisting on two every time. So again, if you propose two at the beginning, that's another hurdle gone past. And on the finances that I mentioned earlier, for instance, if a firm, I'm going to make up a number here, say it needs to put in €500,000 as a capital injection to ensure it meets all its financial requirements in the first 3 years based on its financial projections, and that just about gets a firm by, the central bank is going to challenge its projections on sales and profitability and so on, naturally. Whereas if the firm puts in €1 million or €2 million, and that's not easily done, I'm not suggesting it is, but if there's a good solid margin of capital to be put in way and above, or, you know, above what's actually needed to get across the line, that obviously takes the worry out of that aspect of it for the central bank. And then I refer to the documentation or some of the documentation in relation to risk. There's, you know, documentation in relation to data protection, safeguarding policy, recruitment policy, various, you know, the more of that good corporate stuff that's in there, the happier the central bank will be. This is a serious applicant and so on, and will be not worried, I suppose, is the best thing, that it's taking on in the sector risk that's going to need to be supervised. I suppose summarising that, the more a firm can de-risk from the central bank's perspective, what it's showing to the central bank, the easier it would be for the central bank to move it through the process. And I suppose to make the application as easy as possible for the central bank to understand, I always say, you know, it's not an applicant fintech firm and a big bad regulator. It's human beings on both sides. Yeah. At the end of the day, the people in there in the central bank are doing their job, and the people in the business want to get on with their vision and their business and so on. They're representing their shareholders and so on. So somebody's got to write an application, and somebody's got to read it. So the easier the writer makes it for the reader, the less questions there'll be. And even just, you know, psychologically, in a way, if you can try and if the first impressions are always important, if it comes across as a good application with solid content and taking the regulation seriously and all the rest, obviously it's going to be looked on more favorably than if it's difficult to read, if it's not clear what's been provided, if it's not, if it looks like it's tight on the money or dodgy on the board composition or something. So make it the best application it can be. Now, obviously, there's business restrictions and money restrictions for everybody, and it's that's easy to say in theory. But to be honest, the better you can make that application. And I say to firms, virtually every firm that comes to me as a customer, or even the ones I saw when I was in the central bank, they all want to be authorized yesterday. You know, but actually take an extra couple of days, take an extra couple of weeks and make it a better application actually saves time in the long run. It absolutely definitely does. That's probably, so that's, I should have covered that in the common mistakes earlier. One of the most common mistakes is definitely rushing it.
Okay.
And these things are not to be rushed, to be honest. And it's worth it for both sides to spend that extra time and get it through. So I suppose authorization as quickly as possible. Yeah, if you've got unlimited money and resources, that makes it easy. But yeah, make it the best application it can be, the clearest and cleanest. And that doesn't mean it has to be more money being put into the firm or lots and lots of people, but that it demonstrates that the firm, based on the nature, scale and complexity of the business that it is and the regulated payment services it tends to provide, that the firm will be complying with the regulatory requirements.
Okay, so it's back to the old adage, tus mai laitheann ibre. And for our non-Irish audience, that's an old Irish saying,
yeah.
A good start is half the work done.
Absolutely.
So yeah, glad to hear that's something we can apply to the application process. Where are we with Brexit? Is it done yet? And or where are we with how Brexit has impacted the landscape and the application process in Ireland?
It hasn't really affected the application process, I suppose. And to answer your part of your question, yes, it is done. However, there is still fallout from it in probably quite a positive way for Ireland. Most firms that were providing services into the rest of Europe from the UK have since got set up other, you know, sister companies or whatever somewhere in Europe. In a lot of cases, thankfully, Ireland got their authorization and now providing the services to EU, EEA countries not the UK. UK is not a member anymore, but to the non, their non-UK customers are having service provided from Ireland or wherever. And there's a separate legal entity in the UK continuing to provide services to the UK. There may well be some firms in the UK still providing payment services to countries in Europe. And that's an issue for the regulator in each country to ensure that a firm providing those services is authorized to do so. So in other words, in Ireland's case, there's a different part of the central bank, not the authorization end of things for payments, but watching, I suppose, the landscape in Ireland for firms providing services in Ireland that they're not authorized to do so. So if there was a UK payments firm still providing services into Ireland, it would be breaking the law in doing that. And it's up to the central bank to, I suppose, find them and do something about it. Now, I don't think there's much of any of that, but that's the implication of Brexit. You know, services cannot be provided from the UK. Regulated payment services cannot be provided from a UK company to Ireland or indeed the rest of Europe.
Yeah.
Ongoing though, Cathy, Ireland is probably continuing to benefit from Brexit, in this sector. Obviously, yeah. Overall, it may not be such a good thing for Ireland. But in that, there's obviously new payments, businesses developing all the time. There's payment firms coming in from Asia and the United States and other places that may have typically before gone to the City of London as their European headquarters. But obviously the UK is a different jurisdiction now. So they either go to both or maybe just Europe. And a lot of cases, because of our low corporation tax rate, because of our, we're English speaking, we're the only English speaking country in the EU now, I think. As a first language. And for lots of other reasons, there are firms coming to Ireland. Also, I think we already had a lot of big names here in Ireland anyway, because of, you know, it's the European headquarters for a lot of the internet giants and financial firms. So it was a natural place for them to set up their get their payments authorizations if they needed them. Then obviously a lot of international firms came to Ireland during the Brexit transition from 2016 through to 2020. And now firms coming to Ireland going, well, hey, where are all the payment service or payments firms in Europe getting authorized? And in a lot of cases, it's Ireland. Now, there are some other places like Lithuania and the Netherlands and Luxembourg that do quite well, but we're certainly doing way better than Spain or Germany or France or any of those kind of, sorry, proportionately, than those countries. So we're lucky in this sector in that there are positive aspects of Brexit helping bring jobs and businesses to Ireland. So I suppose, yeah, legally it's done. But we're now enjoying, if you like, the post-Brexit era where firms cannot passport to Europe out of the UK anymore.
Russell, do you foresee any changes to the authorisation process? I mean, you've talked about the pre-application, that meeting is now mandatory. Are there any other developments that you would anticipate?
Not in the process, not in the short term. PSD3 is coming, the Third Payment Service Directive. And obviously, we have a whole podcast about that, I guess, and we will maybe as it gets closer. Like what happened with PSD2, the firms that were already authorized before PSD2 had to get reauthorized, you know, to show that they met any additional requirements brought on by the Second Payment Service Directive. So the same will happen with the third. We won't go into what the potential changes are today, but there will be other things that need to be done by the firms. Now, there was only a 6-month window given last time for firms to get reauthorized, which put a lot of pressure on both the firms and the regulators. I believe they're allowing 2 years for it next time. So the authorization process will have to change to at least accommodate the reauthorization of those firms and the application requirements changing from whatever they are now to whatever they will be under PSD3. So there will be change to the authorization process to at least accommodate those changes. And maybe the central bank will use the opportunity to make tweaks to its own, you know, authorization process itself. Between now and then, I don't see the central bank significantly changing its process. I do believe, though, in terms of its own requirements around how it assesses firms demonstrating their adherence to the regulations. They have a reputation for being robust. Let me put it this way. I don't see them getting any less robust in that. So further documentation or further evidence of the strength of a firm's governance or risk management or financial sustainability may be required. So it may just become a little bit more onerous on firms in the process. But again, most of that stuff is all good from a business perspective. It's not the central bank just asking this for the sake of it. Obviously, from a business running a business point of view, the better control framework you have, the better financial position you're in, and so on, are all good things, not bad things. The only ones that are likely to cause stress, if you like, or there might be a difference of opinion, might be, like I mentioned earlier, say, for instance, the dual hatting of certain roles, like risk and compliance being done by one person in the startup phase, might seem reasonable to a firm, whereas the central bank might like to see them separate. So there might be a little bit on that. But yeah, no, maybe more prepared board-approved documentation ahead of the authorization might be required going forward. But yeah, no, I don't really see before PSD3 any significant change in the process itself.
Russell, we're coming to the end of our tour of the authorization process. Finally, could you just give me what are your key takeaways or messages that you'd have for anybody embarking on the authorization process and an application process, and for those who are perhaps struggling mid-application?
Well, actually, I'll start, if you don't mind, with the struggling mid-application. My advice to firms would be talk to the central bank about it. Ask for a meeting, send them an email setting out what your concerns are. And I have found, well, obviously I was in there at one stage, but working with firms on the other side now, any firm that sort of puts their hand up and asks for help or asks for clarification, the central bank are always very accommodating. Now, ultimately, the firm may not like the message they hear from the central bank, but the central bank will be transparent in giving that message. But if a firm is struggling, or if a firm is, in fact, I'd nearly recommend to firms to do this anyway if they're in any doubt, because sometimes when you get together and meet these guys across the table or online, like maybe in some cases, but they're more across the table nowadays, which is good. I said earlier, it's humans dealing with humans. People get to see each other. They
Yes,
realize these guys are
exactly.
okay. And oh, is that what you meant by that? Is that what you meant by that? Doesn't translate too well in an email sometimes. Sometimes, oh God, if that's all you need, well then I can give you that. So yeah, absolutely. My advice would be, obviously, if you've engaged an advisor to help you, obviously maybe they might be able to help you. But oh, absolutely, with or without an advisor, ask to talk to the central bank. They always seem to be very accommodating with meetings. And as I say, they're pretty open and transparent about it. Back to the key takeaways overall, what I said earlier about being prepared, don't rush into this, don't be under any illusions, do whatever it takes to find out exactly how onerous and big a commitment this is. It's not a light lift, it's a heavy lift, even for a small firm, because the central bank, whilst it does recognize proportionality of risk, so some very small firms with very low risk that maybe, you know, an AISP, an account information service provider only, or it's not even touching the money, central bank will still expect a certain size board, a certain amount of management, and a certain degree of, you know, three lines of defense in terms of risk management and so on. And that's obviously very more onerous proportionally on a smaller firm. But so to be under no illusion that making an application for authorization requires, you know, a lot of commitment. So fully understand what you're getting into. And as I mentioned earlier, be driven by your business vision and plan. Don't be driven by the regulations. So absolutely be clear on your business vision and what it takes to deliver that business plan. And if regulation is part of that, so be it. You find that out and make sure that they're incorporated into the delivery of your business plan. Getting that authorization is a requirement for you achieving a successful business. And then I suppose be prepared to be flexible. Every journey is different. There'll always be a surprise that nobody anticipated. It doesn't mean that there's anything wrong. It just means that somebody sees something differently or nobody thought of that or whatever. And everything can be solved. Back to the example I've used a couple of times. If it requires, you know, hiring a separate head of risk to compliance, so be it. Maybe that solves the problem. Or maybe it's injection of a little bit more capital. Or maybe it's simply choosing a different safeguarding method, something like that. But just be prepared to be required to be flexible somewhere along the way. Yeah. It's likely not to be without its surprises. And also, I suppose, if you're confident, if a firm has a solid business plan and is confident that it's meeting the authorization requirements, then actually it's not like Dragon's Den. It's not like the central bank decides whether it likes you or not.
Yeah, exactly.
If a firm demonstrates its compliance with the regulations, the central bank has to grant it that authorization. A firm should, you know, be confident. If a firm has got everything right and has done the homework, has done the hard work, then ultimately it will get there. And I think, like, yes, you've got to take it seriously, but don't be afraid of pushing on and getting to the end of that journey. And if you talk to any of the authorized firms, and I'm lucky enough to have worked with 40% of them, even in the 2.5 years since I left the central bank. So I get a lot of feedback from them. And there's nobody more pro-central bank than somebody who's just been authorized, even if they've had a long, tough journey getting there. Oh, yeah, it's a great thing. The central bank is a very robust process and all the rest. And obviously, they're going to be supervised by the central bank going forward. And actually, in the introduction you suggested and the journey that happens thereafter, it's a team in the same directorate, but it is a separate team that supervises than the team that was involved in the authorization, which may be a comfort to some of these firms after being through the authorization process. But both are good sets of people, obviously, and they have their own functions to perform. And again, even on the when you get through that journey, if you've got any questions or queries or doubts, even as a now authorized firm, don't be afraid to, you know, contact the central bank and ask about it.
Yeah, and of course the central bank now has accumulated a lot of experience in handling these applications and going through these applications. I mean, absent your own departure from the central bank, and I'm sure that was a there's a lot of loss of corporate memory there, but the central bank itself has a lot of insights itself, so it does know what it's talking about when it comes to authorizing a firm and reviewing and assessing an application. So
yeah, just to give our listeners a sort of a sense of scale here, in quarter four of 2018 we had, I think it was 14 authorized firms, 12 payment institutions and 2 e-money institutions. 14, right? We now have 48, plus 4 AISPs and on post. So like the sector has, you know, almost quadrupled in that time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, and most of that experience is since 2018.
Yeah.
Right. Of course, since 2018, if it was quarter four 2018, but most of the experience is obviously in very much recent years, sort of Brexit and what followed. So there's been a lot of learning by the central bank and obviously by the industry over the last 5 years particularly.
So on that positive note, thank you, Russell, for sharing your insights and expertise on this really important topic. And thanks to you for listening to the Compliance Files podcast brought to you by the Compliance Institute. I do hope that you find the podcast interesting and useful, and we would be very grateful if you would review or rate this podcast. Until the next episode, goodbye. We'll be right back.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Compliance Files. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on whatever platform you are listening to ensure you don't miss out on future episodes.